So South Korea's fertility rate is 0.72. I'll just leave that there for a second. That's 0.72 children per woman, and that is the lowest number ever recorded for any country in human history. And it isn't because of a war or famine or because of anything that you can point to on a map. It's just people looking at their lives and making a decision. Which I don't know, depending on how your week's going, might be the most understandable thing you ever heard. And the thing is South Korea isn't really an outlier here. They're more like an early adopter because you've got Japan, Italy, Spain, China. They're all heading in the same direction. They're just slightly behind in the queue. So by 2100, the projections have about six countries on the planet that are still going to be replacing their own populations. Six. The rest have apparently other plans, or maybe no plans, which I guess is the point. And I'm not super interested in the economic explanation of this, even though that's where the conversation usually goes. And it is, of course, a factor. I mean, we've got housing costs, student debt, childcare, healthcare costs. And yeah, it's all real, it's all documented. And nonetheless, completely unable to explain why 37 out of 38 developed nations independently arrived at the same answer. I mean, I think you'd need a lot of expensive apartments to account for that kind of coordination, right? I think something else is going on. And the number itself is trying to say it, if you're willing to listen to a statistic the way that you'd listen to someone who's given up trying to explain themselves and is just showing you what they decided. Because having a child, I mean, underneath all the other things, is it's an act of faith in the future, in the world. I'd say it's an act of faith in the general idea of whatever this is worth continuing. And in a rather discreet way, in all of these countries, among people who've never met and don't share a common language, that faith has been running low for some reason. I mean, I wouldn't say it's completely gone, it's just become diminished. Like the way sound dissipates in a room when everyone leaves. You don't really notice it or notice how quiet it is at first. So there is this, there's a sociologist named Ray Oldenburg who spent a lot of his career writing about what he called third places. And if you're not familiar with what that is, it's this concept. It's pretty simple. I mean, it's probably why it took losing them to get everyone to pay attention. So the first place, is home. The second place is work. And the third place is basically everything in between. So the bookstore, the, you know, the pub where the bartender already knew your order, the diner where you'd run into someone that you half knew and you'd end up talking to them longer than you planned, the barber shop, the park bench that somehow had always had the same people on it every Sunday morning, like they'd all gotten the same memo. I think you probably get the idea, especially if you're of a certain age to remember this stuff. And, you know, nobody organized any of this. It just kind of happened naturally and repeatedly. And this is how people used to meet. You know, things were different. And I think if you look underneath the academic framing, you know, what Oldenburg was really saying is that these places, they weren't optional. They were more like supporting walls that you didn't notice until they're gone. And then suddenly the whole structure feels off and you can't quite understand why, at least not at first. And these places have been disappearing for quite some time now. In some cases, morphing into liminal spaces. Dirk Thompson wrote a piece in The Atlantic last year that he called the antisocial century. And one of the statistics in it that caught my attention is Americans now spend about an hour and 40 minutes more per day at home than they did in 2003. And that wasn't the pandemic's doing. I mean, this was already happening before any of that. The pandemic just gave it like a medical note and an excuse to make it permanent. And then there's this other interesting number. The percentage of men under 30 with no close friends went from 3% in 1990 to 15% now, which I think is, that's the kind of statistic that sounds almost abstract until you start actually taking some inventory on people you actually know. So, okay. In the year 2000, Robert Putnam basically predicted all of this in his very good book called Bowling Alone. So you had civic clubs that were emptying out. Neighborhoods were starting to go silent. People were joining less, knowing their neighbors less. They were just showing up less in various ways. And this is all before smartphones and social media came along. So Putnam called this a social capital crisis. And the cultural response to this was something like, huh, well, that's concerning. And then everyone just went home alone, which, you know, basically proved his point, I guess. The third place didn't just vanish overnight. it got gradually zoned out of existence in certain places, and then priced out in other places, of course. Starbucks, for example, figured out that people who linger in their stores aren't people who buy more coffee. So what they did was they discreetly redesigned their spaces to discourage it. You know, they basically started removing the furniture, which is a rather shrewd business decision, but I'd say also a pretty effective way of contributing to the atomization of society, and, you know, a way to make a city feel like it doesn't quite belong to anyone anymore. And so somewhere in all of that, you know, people stopped running into each other. And instead, they started to internalize this and started wondering, well, what's wrong with them? And that last part is what gets me, because the way we talk about loneliness, I think it just keeps getting stuck in the wrong register. It's apparently, it's a health crisis now. And yeah, the numbers are not great, because studies have shown that chronic loneliness carries roughly the same mortality risk as smoking. You've probably heard this stat somewhere before. So 15 cigarettes a day, which is what I used to smoke when I quit 16 years ago. That's the kind of statistic that makes you want to light one up just to feel something. But by calling it a health crisis, it gives it a way of sounding solvable. Like there's a treatment protocol somewhere that just needs more funding, right? I think what it actually is something older and more difficult to name than that. Okay, more statistics. So around 40% of American adults say that they're lonely. 69% said last year that they needed more emotional support than they got. Which means that most people are running a deficit on the most basic human thing there is and just going about their day anyway, because, you know, what else are you going to do? So, Emile Durkheim had this concept that he called anomie. So anomie is the condition of being basically unmoored from wherever shared structure used to make existence feel like it had some kind of shape. And he identified it as like the precondition for a particular kind of disappearance. Nothing too crazy. Just a person who has slowly run out of stakes and who has nothing left that actually requires them to be here. And by the way, Durkheim was writing about this way back in the 1890s. So, yeah, that's going well. And then Hannah Arendt, back when she was writing about how totalitarianism takes hold in a society, made this argument that loneliness is the, it's the precondition. So the idea being that a person who's lost their stakes in a shared world is a person who is available in ways that are difficult to explain until you've actually felt it yourself. Now, she was writing this around the 1930s, and I've been thinking about her work lately for reasons that I probably don't need to spell out here. Now, the word that both of them kept circling is stakes. What do you have stakes in? You know, what would notice the specific shape of your absence? And I think that's the thing underneath the loneliness statistics that we don't really hear much about. It's not that it's, you know, it's not just that people are alone. It's that a lot of people have lost the sense that their being here is particularly required by anything. I mean, you can have a full calendar and still feel that way. You know, you can be watching 100,000 people and feel that way. Yeah, presence doesn't really fix it. I mean, visibility doesn't really fix it. Everyone's present, but nobody's really quite there. So, all right, let's go back to that number in the beginning, 0.72, South Korea. And the 37 out of 38 developed nations below the replacement rate. And the global fertility rate that's dropped from 5 children per woman in the 1950s to where it is now, still falling and projected to hit 1.6 by the year 2100. And the standard explanation, as I said earlier, is economic, which is fine as far as that goes. I mean, economics is definitely a factor in this. And we all know that housing is these days very unaffordable. Child care costs are outrageously expensive. Student debt, you know, that's a whole other conversation. But I keep getting stuck on the fact that the economic explanation doesn't quite account for the uniformity of what's happening. I mean, 37 countries with different economies, different cultures, governments, different histories, and they all arrive at the same answer independently. Now, that doesn't strike me as a coincidence. That's a conversation nobody seems to want to have. Jean Baudrillard spent a lot of time on this idea that in society, we've replaced the real thing with a convincing enough copy to the point that eventually most people stopped asking which was which. Now, he called it a simulation of sorts, not to be confused with the you know, the sci-fi simulation theory. He just meant that somewhere along the way, the performance of having a community started standing in for actually having one. Social media, anyone? So this includes the performance of intimacy, the performance of a meaningful life. Close enough to the original that you don't really notice the difference until something goes wrong and you're disoriented searching for the real thing. You know, the internet is very much an alternate reality, and we get lost in it, and most of us don't even realize it. I think about this in the context of the birth rate, because reproduction is maybe the most biological, most irreducibly real thing a person can do. And it requires a certain baseline of faith in the actual. You know, and the idea that there is a real, non-simulated world that's worth bringing someone into. And I wonder if the childcare explanation is just the thing people say because, you know, the real answer, it's just harder to articulate. Something about faith wearing thin, you know, the kind of thing that happens to a person gradually without a specific moment you can point to. Because having a child, it is an act of faith in the future. And, you know, faith tends to require some evidence that the present is worth extending. Now, I'm not saying people are consciously opting out of civilization. I don't think it's that coherent. I think it's more like the answer is coming back the same way a body responds to a bad environment. The body doesn't file a complaint. It just stops at some point. And then, you know, that's either the most alarming thing I've said so far or the most honest, depending on where you're sitting with all this. Probably both, if I'm being straight about it. So, the third place, it didn't just suddenly disappear and leave this giant hole or something. It something moved in. I think about the parasocial relationship thing. You know, like, for example, like the podcaster that you've been listening to for 3 years, who at this point feels like a friend, right? There's this specific quality that the parasocial bond has where it reacts to you in the sense that the algorithm learns what you respond to and keeps serving it back, which then creates this sensation of being understood. But, you know, without the discomfort of actually being known. And, you know, when you say it out loud, it's I think it's a pretty efficient way to get the feeling without the exposure. And I get it. I mean, I genuinely get it. Because, you know, being known by an actual human in person is, well, it requires you to be vulnerable, right? And to, you know, it asks you to consistently show up and be, sometimes be wrong in front of someone who will probably remember it. And on the other hand, the parasocial version asks nothing. It's available 24/7 And, you know, it doesn't have needs. It's just that it also doesn't really have you. Eric Fromm wrote something about what people do when genuine freedom and genuine connection start feeling too difficult. So he said that the reason people surrender to conformity and consumption is because those things just feel safer than the alternative. And the alternative, he meant, was the terrifying work of actually being truly present in your own life. And the other thing that moved in was work. So, when the third place dies, the second place, that's what expands to fill it. And then work becomes the social infrastructure. The Slack channel becomes, that becomes the place where you feel known. The team becomes the community. Which would be fine, except that work can suddenly end, right? Or restructure or something. You know, the problem with work is that it can decide on you know, a random weekday afternoon that your position has been eliminated. At which point your community evaporates along with your salary. And then there is the nostalgia economy. Like the vinyl record, the vintage or the retro diner aesthetic in a restaurant that opened 8 months ago. There's this deliberate recreation of the feeling of places that used to exist organically and now are available for a cover charge. And that's probably a very Baudrillard thing to notice. But I think it's also a little depressing when you walk past one of these places on a Saturday night or whatever. And I don't mean to imply that these substitutes are evil or something. I mean, depending on how it's done, I think some of them are, they can be comforting in a way, like, I don't know, like a photograph of somewhere you used to love is comforting. The thing is it's just that a photograph doesn't have a bartender who knows your order. It doesn't have the ambient noise of other people existing alongside you without requiring anything from you. And I think somewhere in the distance between what we have now and what that felt like is that's where a lot of the light went. Okay, so I guess we've reached the part where I'm supposed to tell you what to do about all this. And I'm not really going to do that. And it's not because I'm being coy or anything. It's just that I think the whole, you know, at least in this case, the what to do framing is part of the problem. Because it assumes the thing that we're looking at is a malfunction. You know, something that deviated from the correct path and needs redirecting back toward it. And I'm not really sure that that's what this is. I think we might actually be looking at a correction. And I want to be careful with that word, because it doesn't necessarily mean that I think collapse is fine. But a civilization that systematically dismantles the conditions for humans belonging, and then watches its population gradually lose interest in perpetuating itself, that's not a mystery. That is a response. At least that's what it looks like to me. The organism just responded honestly to the environment it was given. It was adapting, which is what organisms do. Humans made a world optimized for productivity and consumption and individual isolation, and then seemed genuinely surprised when people stopped wanting to produce more people to live in it. And I find something almost clarifying in that. I mean, it's not exactly comfortable, but it's clarifying, because a mystery implies bad luck or something. A response implies causation, and causation implies that the thing isn't random, which means it's at least theoretically possible to do something different. Now, whether we will, that's a whole other question entirely. What I think is more useful than some five-step plan is just, we should just be honest about the scale of what got lost. We lost an environment that allowed third places, where you had neighbors you actually knew, a coffee shop that's now just a place for laptop workers with headphones. Maybe the video rental store, if you remember those. The laundromat, the library, and just the sense of having stakes in something that could feel your absence. These weren't small things that got replaced by better things. They were supportive, and they're gone, and the building is tilting now, and most of the conversation about it is still debating whether the tilt is actually really happening. And I keep coming back to the question of when this exactly happened, because it wasn't an event. There was no specific date to point to. It's more like the way daylight starts fading after the summer solstice, right? You don't notice it's going. You just notice one evening that it's darker than you expected, and you can't remember the last time it wasn't. It just creeps up on you. I think a lot of people are living in that kind of dark right now. And I think the birth rate and the loneliness numbers and the empty storefront where the diner used to be, I think they're all the same thing, but they're just wearing like different clothes. And maybe that's just what this is, you know? Civilizations, they're not exempt from the same rules as everything else that's existed. They rise and they get complicated and they produce philosophy and coffee mugs and fertility statistics, and then they go the way things go. I mean, the dinosaurs didn't see it coming either. Or maybe they did for a few minutes anyway. I mean, look, we're temporary. The things we build are temporary. And whatever belonging we had and lost was temporary. And I realize that this doesn't make the loss any smaller. It just puts it in a different light, I guess. And I don't really know right now what you're supposed to do with that exactly. I just think it's worth knowing what the light used to look like, and also just accepting how it changes. And that's it. And I guess that's all I've got for you today. As always, thanks for listening.